I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Georgia Republican Senator David Perdue is rebuilding his election war chest. Meanwhile, another Georgia Democrat has jumped into the race to challenge him. But is the Democratic Party waiting and hoping for someone else? Meanwhile, the new child sex trafficking charges against Jeffrey Epstein in New York have brought new focus to Georgia's efforts to fight sex trafficking. And if Georgia and some other states win their lawsuit against Obamacare, is there a plan for what next for patients here? Lot to think about on this political breakfast. Great to have you with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Theron Johnson is back. He's a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Brian Robinson is away, filling in this time, former Georgia Republican Party Chairman Chuck Clay, now with the law firm of Hall Booth Smith. Hello to you both, and welcome back to Chuck Clay.
Always a pleasure.
It is so good to be back. I'm excited.
Let's look at this Senate race. Republican Senator David Perdue stockpiling cash already. Meanwhile, Democrats are still trying to decide whether to jump in or out. Clarkston Mayor Ted Terry joined the field. It already includes Columbus Mayor Teresa Tomlinson and Akhenaten Amun, a high school teacher. And there's still rumors about whether former Lieutenant Governor candidate Sarah Riggs Amico might jump in. There are even John Ossoff rumors out there. All right, Theron, do the Democrats have the field they really want?
Not yet. But with the recent entrance of Ted Terry, who is a young rock star, who's an outstanding mayor of Clarkston, who's kind of coined himself as the millennial mayor, he's going to bring a new sort of innovative approach with some strategic fundraising. He has an extensive amount of fundraising background. But also, you know, he's very progressive, and he's taken some stances as mayor that in a Democratic primary for U.S. Senate may or may not resonate with our electorate.
But will it resonate with a general electorate? You've got legalization of marijuana, for instance. Income inequality has been a big issue for him, along with climate change. The stances he takes on these may be critical in a Democratic primary, but what about in a general?
Well, Dennis, as you know, I'm always the one to objectively say that it's all about winning the general for Democrats in Georgia. However, I do think if you're Ted Terry, I think he wants to identify himself and kind of build a narrative, but I do think it's going to be sort of a left to moderate message. But look, I do think that there's still an opportunity for a person of color to enter this race. And we know, Dennis, the majority of the votes in a Democratic primary statewide are going to be women of color. Mm-hmm. And so hypothetically, if a woman of color or a male of color decided to enter this race, it puts all of these announced candidates and particularly future announced candidates in a particular interesting situation.
So you raise a tantalizing question here because Ted Terry, Sarah Riggs Amico, Teresa Tomlinson are not people of color. Are the Democrats secretly, desperately seeking Stacey?
No, I think Stacey Abrams has made it very clear, Dennis. And, you know, and honestly, I think she's out. Another thing I want to say is this, is that I do think that this competition in a primary is good. There's been some Democrats that say we need to clear the field, we need to kind of get a consensus candidate. And honestly, Dennis, I've been one of those critics in the past. But I do think if you really look at where we are as a country and some of the pressing issues that we face as a state. I think the more the merrier. Let's have an open debate about what's best for this state and what's best for the country, and everyone have an opportunity to share ideas.
I would just say my life experiences on trying to clear the field has been a success zero.
When you've run a few races.
When folks got the bit in the teeth, I think Theron's right on all counts. I will say the one that I know, Ms. Tomlinson, I think are very credible, and I'm assuming the others are too. Can they raise the money and get the gin going against a senator who is extremely well-liked, who has been very popular, has avoided controversy, but has been a good, sound conservative voice and a rising star in Washington, D.C.?
And he's raised almost $5 million already. Teresa Tomlinson, the top fundraiser among the potential Democratic challengers, raised around $500,000. So there's a big discrepancy there in a race that Democrats are targeting.
Steep climb against a very, very A-plus candidate with David Perdue.
So, Theron, is there a lack of enthusiasm among Democrats in a race where there should be loads of enthusiasm?
You know, let's be fair. I mean, you have an incumbent in David Perdue, and I will push back a little bit on my friend Chuck Clay. He hasn't had a tenure without controversy. He actually supports one of the most controversial politicians in the world right now, and that is President Donald Trump. What he has done successfully, Chuck, is that he has, in an unwavering way, been a staunch supporter of this president. So that means that he takes the good and he also takes the bad that comes with this president, who we know is struggling to get over 40% as far as approval rating. But to be fair to Teresa Tomlinson, would she have wanted to and needed to raise more money? Absolutely. When you're running against an incumbent, it's going to be tough. But I do think—
Yeah, and look at Amy McGrath up there in Kentucky, who just announced a challenge to Mitch McConnell. Mm-hmm. And she raked in a couple of million in a few days.
So I think what you're seeing, and you saw in her numbers, her being Teresa Tomlinson, I believe, and I'm not on the campaign and I haven't talked to anyone, but it is my suspicion that they focus very specific on Georgia donors. One of the things that they taunted in their press release is that I think they had roughly pretty close to almost 3,500, 3,600 actual donors that were in Georgia. I think like upwards to 70, maybe 80% of their donations are from Georgia. But in order to be competitive against a well-funded candidate in Georgia like David Perdue, who's really beyond just Georgia, I mean, this is a national senator, you're going to have to raise upwards to the tens of millions of dollars to run a competitive campaign.
Chuck Clay, in a general election, as long as we're talking about the primary strategy, which he doesn't even have to worry about, versus the general, does David Perdue say, I'm Donald Trump's man in Washington, and is that a winning strategy in a changing Georgia?
I guess we'll find out, because I think Theron is right in a way. He has been an ally of this president. I think this president is growing stronger. This is not my choice when he ran, so I'm not a sycophant or necessarily an opponent. But you'd be blind not to see that I think Trump has been on an uphill climb, basically because of the economy and other things that have appeal, particularly in the minority communities, whether it be African American, Hispanic, Asian, or otherwise. So a slight change there is significant. Perdue is his own man, though. He is a very sound and excellent candidate and campaigner. He's a great retail politician. Folks like him.
And I would say this, listen, you know, during the primary, Chuck, you remember that Jack Kingston, you know, a guy from Athens mm-hmm. who I've known for a long time, but really cut his teeth in politics in Savannah. I made the bold prediction that I thought that David Perdue was going to beat Jack Kingston. I think there were some others in the field. Let me tell you why I made that prediction. What he did at that time, and we'll see if he does it in 2020, he ran as the first outsider. Before there was Trump as an outsider and sort of as a disruptor of kind of, you know, the establishment of the Republican Party, you had David Perdue, who really coined the phrase as an outsider.
And which is interesting because as the head of Dollar General, as a cousin of Sonny Perdue, it's fascinating that he was able to convince a lot of folks that he's this complete outsider, stranger to the political world.
Well, I found over the years that the outsider means you just haven't been elected before. you just want to be an insider, though. But he's done a marvelous job. And there's another story. That axis of the Perdues in Washington is probably the strongest thing that Georgia's had going for it, good, bad, or indifferently. I think it's great. But since Newt Gingrich, Sam Nunn. Mm-hmm.
And so, to my point, his team, and I want to get back to, I think, where he really kind of gets the edge right now, not just because of his fundraising, not because of all the things that Chuck just said, but now he goes from an outsider to being really kind of perceived by some as the ultimate presidential insider. I mean, he is the person that in Washington has ingrained himself in the politics there and has been the number one supporter and advocate in the Senate and outside the Senate for this president. And so what's going to be very interesting is that now you have a record. Now you have to come home and defend this record and this voting record. And then you have to defend the president's record. But I do think that David Perdue, if he goes back to the jean jacket, standing in the cornfield somewhere in North or South Georgia, which my mom called me and said, look, I'm not going to vote for him, but man, he shows a nice looking man. I mean, are we going to get that David Perdue?
That's what I should have done.
Or are we going to get a David Perdue who comes back to Georgia and runs a very conservative campaign with a little less of the outsider message?
I'll make it quick. Perdue goes in the win column for the Republicans. Yeah, he's going back.
But does he, to answer Theron's question, Chuck, if you were advising David Perdue, would you say, okay, go back to that outsider message? Or are you now so inside that people won't buy it and you need to run to the Trump base?
No, I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, you're an incumbent now. That's inevitable. And as an incumbent, you are going to have a record to both run on and defend. I don't think that changes whether necessarily Trump or not. Perdue is a recognized name in this state on his own. He will choose at what level will the presidency be involved. I suspect he will stand close to him.
But one of the things I vividly remember when he was a candidate and became the senator, and you know, his chief of staff, Derek Dickey, is one of the best in the business, and he's been around a long time. and I know these guys listen to the podcast too, Chuck, so that's why I'm shocked.
Well, Derek, I got to call you on something. So if you're listening, expect to see my name on your phone messaging.
But he did, and he had people like, you know, Martha Zoller, who mm-hmm. went to work for Governor Kemp, who now is back on the radio. And so he did make a valid effort, and I think is quietly still making an effort to be open to Democrats. He's listened to people who has a different message than he has, and basically thinks that the country needs to go in a different direction. So what you're seeing is when you're an incumbent U.S. senator, you have the power of incumbency, but you also have constituent services. And he's got people all around the state that's delivering federal benefits, federal services for all the people.
He's a senator for everybody in this state, and his door's been open, and that's one of the reasons he's been successful.
Theron, to come back to a question you kind of hinted at. You mentioned the Democrats may see a major candidate of color, particularly a woman of color, and you've ruled out Stacey Abrams, so are there other names out there?
I think what's going on in this country right now, Dennis, is that if you are an aspiring politician, and then let's say you don't want to go the route that I've chosen, if you right now want to let whatever enthusiasm or passion move you, I think, Dennis, that we may find someone who's not even elected right now. We could find a David Perdue-like candidate who happens
someone
to—
Someone from the business community?
Someone from the business community.
Okay, we want names. We want
I don't have names right now. I don't have names right now, but I'm telling you that I think that if you are just an American, right, no matter whether you're Democrat or Republican, if you think that this country could be heading in a different direction, if you feel that you have something to offer, I think you get that. But then also, listen, I do think that there's some county commissioners, state reps, state senators, they may look at this race as an opportunity to get in there. And that person may just happen to be of color. And I think if that happens, Dennis, we saw it happen with Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans, it's a game changer.
Theron, Georgia Democrats have spent years trying to build a bench that had been depleted in the years after they lost the legislature and the governor's mansion. And there's no doubt that they have built up that bench somewhat. But is this kind of uncertain Democratic Senate field a sign that they haven't quite built up the bench to where it needs to be?
We got candidates. I mean, we literally are going to probably have at least 4 to 5 candidates. What you're alluding to, Dennis, and I think it's very interesting, is that we want the perfect candidate. And I'm here to tell my fellow Democrats that that person does not exist. How you find the best candidate is to do what Ted Terry just did and to take this quantum leap and say, hey, look, I know I'm giving up a seat. I know it's an uphill climb, but if you look at his messaging, is that he just thinks that in order to change things, you got to do things differently. And so I think you're going to see more and more people take that Ted Terry approach and want to get in here and have a conversation.
So having spent most of my career on building the Republican Party, I've walked in these shoes for a long, long time.
You saw it when the shoe was on the other foot.
And there weren't very many of us out there. And I think you're right. You got to build up, and quality attracts quality. You've got to get quality people to run in the seats where you have the best chance of winning. And it's sometimes a little bit difficult to match that up. But if you have good candidates, the Michelle Nunns of the world, the Jason Carters of the world, these are very credible candidates that didn't win, but I think it probably behooved and represented the Democratic Party, I hate to admit it, but very well. The Republicans' task is obviously to not let that occur without us having a credible alternative in maintaining that access to voters in those areas that really are the swing districts throughout this state.
How scared are Republicans, Chuck, that the improving Democratic bench is a threat right now to take either David Perdue's seat or a majority in the State House of Representatives?
Look, it's been an eye-awakener and maybe a little bit of a shock treatment, but that message is pretty loud and clear in the Republican caucuses and at the local level. They're not blind to what occurred last time or the changing demographics. This is something that we've been discussing for decades, and that's sort of coming to fruition. The Republicans' job is to not be complacent and not further tighten the circle so you have fewer and fewer people who agree and agree more. And you better be out there to be in these districts where that truly are very mixed politically. You better be able to appeal across the board, or you're not going to get elected in those districts, either party.
But one of the things I don't want our listeners to sort of take from what I'm saying is that I do think right now, Dennis and Chuck, that we have a qualified field of people who has declared and who will declare to be U.S. Senator. I mean, Teresa Tomlinson, I mean, let's not underscore this woman and what she's been able to accomplish. I mean, she is representing, you know, area in our state that is going to be pivotal for Democrats to do better in. It's a place
Central Georgia,
in central, sort of central south, you know, West Georgia, where Republicans have done very well, and Governor Brian Kemp and Senator David Perdue has done well there. But also, this is a woman who I think, listen, let's just call it what it is. This is the podcast. We're not going to sugarcoat stuff. If Teresa Tomlinson had raised $2 million or $3 million, then maybe we would have, I think Ted Terry still would have declared. I think Ted Terry made up his mind months ago that he was going to run. But it probably would have scared off some folks who now saying, wow, this woman has only raised, you know, $600,000. She's got about $500,000 on hand. And Ted Terry is really taunting that he'll be able to come in and get some of this outside money. But then don't forget about this guy, John Ossoff. And I got to say this because I know Brian is going to be listening to this podcast while he's sipping a mojito on the beach right now and playing with his beautiful daughter and his wife. Is that this now, if I'm a John Ossoff and I know that I can at least go back out and get a fourth of what I raised before in a conservative congressional district, I think he's really kind of saying, all right, guys, I can come in here. But I think that Ossoff and others, I go back to, if a person of color gets in this race, it changes the dynamic totally. And I think that everyone who's thinking about running or who is running has got to basically factor that in.
Chuck, I want to turn to you on this one. Speaking of the Democratic bench, State Senate Democratic leader Steve Henson, whom I know you know.
Yeah, very well.
Has decided not to seek reelection. He had a really tough primary battle in 2018. He is, if I'm not mistaken, the last white Democratic male in the state Senate. So is this a sign of where Republicans might look at what's happening and say, the Democrats, and we hear this message from Republicans all the time, they're pushing some voters away?
First, I'd be remiss not to say best wishes to Steve. We were sweet mates, and actually we were grooms in a particular wedding a number of years ago. And I consider
him
just a fine, fine man, and it will be the state's loss, hopefully his and his family's gain. I think what he's done reflects wisdom. Now, the answer is short term, yeah, I do think it creates potentially some opportunities in districts for Republicans that had been pretty much run across the board in the last elections in places like DeKalb and most of Gwinnett County and some of Cobb.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I agree with Chuck. I mean, Steve Henson has been a person that has been involved in Democratic politics for a long time. A lot of us forget, Dennis, and I know you remember this, that he faced now CEO Michael Thurman in a very, very competitive Democratic primary for labor commissioner back in 1998. And one of the things that I admire most about him as being a registered lobbyist, and I know Chuck has spent a lot of time at the Capitol as well, is that he definitely served the role of being the minority leader very well. I mean, he was the person that when the Republicans saw going to the well, if they were up there taking questions about a particular bill, they know that Steve Henson is going to challenge them in a very, very factual way. And so he's going to be missed. And I want to just publicly thank him for his service. And I do think that he will continue to be very, very involved with state politics in some capacity.
But having been a minority leader, I can share his pain. but he does what I think is important in that position, a face of what you represent. And his was open, honest, fun, delightful, caring, and successful.
And he had a tough primary. I mean, let's
be honest. He won by about just over 100 votes.
He had a young lady running against him, Sabrina McKenzie at the time, and she tapped into something in that district. So that district is a solid Democratic district, but it's changing because it has the parts of DeKalb and Gwinnett.
We both challenged to get these people who really do see themselves as independent, in many cases professional, though not necessarily, and they're going to go to where they think people talk to them. Not a label. They just are.
So, Theron, is this a sign of a demographic change in terms of racial makeup in the state Senate, or is it also a generational change?
I think it's a confluence of both. He can still lead this caucus. However, all right, I've been doing this for almost, 30 years or so. Now it's time for a younger person to step up. The other conversation that we're having in the state, and it's also playing out at a national level, you look at what's going on with Speaker Pelosi and some of the new members of the House caucus, it's not as public here as it is on a national level. But yeah, there are some senators and state reps who we need to watch out for. Even just in the House, you got people like William Bodie and James Beverly, who are new state representatives, who are definitely figuring out a way. And when Bob Trimble decides that he may not want to, do something.
The House Minority Leader.
Yeah, House Minority Leader. But no, I do think that it's a third phase of this, too, and it's sort of the ideas. I mean, if you look at the Democratic Party chair of Georgia, Nikema Williams, who's also a state senator, who also made national news in her peaceful protest, but she was arrested at the state capitol and got her charges dropped. So I don't know if I would have seen doing Henson when he first started in politics, voluntarily, peacefully protesting and getting arrested and it becoming this big national kind of news. I don't think that was a tactic that was used then, but now you're going to see more and more of those tactics used by these sort of younger elected officials in the state Senate and House.
So more confrontation, perhaps.
Yeah, because listen, I think that, as my mentor and my hero would say, Congressman John Lewis, is that we all need to get in some good trouble. And I think that you're going to see more and more elected officials get in some good trouble.
So do Republicans in the Senate, particularly the state Senate, Chuck, turn that to their advantage? Or is this something that they really haven't encountered before and may have trouble dealing with?
It depends. I mean, you don't know until you don't know what you don't know, as Mr. Rumsfeld would say. But it's a fine, fine line. Do I think it creates opportunity to look like you're the wise statesman? Yes. Does it take the risk like you're looking like you're trying to, one, throttle debate, two, put a thumb on, and particularly beat up on, in many cases, women? You got to be real careful with that politically. So a little bit of both.
And Chuck just hit on something. Let's not forget one of the biggest things that I think faced Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan in winning a very, contested race in his primary, but also, he went on to win the general. One of the first things that happened is that he dealt with State Senator Renee Utterman. And you see this picture that is going to be there, I'm sure, in the Georgia Museums, of you have this one white woman. It's standing, in front and kind of in the middle of all these white men.
With the co-sponsors of the heartbeat bill behind her, who were all men.
All men. And then, and we know what it was. It was basically based on a committee assignment that the Duncan people, I think, handled pretty well. But they also have a white woman, suburban kind of like white woman problem within the Republican Party that they're going to have to continue to be delicate about.
They not only have to be delicate about, they have to do better about.
Right.
And we're going to talk some more about the suburbs, specifically the 7th Congressional District, which has gotten very crowded on both sides in the race to succeed Rob Woodall. That's coming up on The Political Breakfast and a lot more. Stay right here.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
And we are back on The Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Thanks for keeping us company. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson is back with us, filling in for Brian Robinson this time, former GOP State Chair Chuck Clay. Let's talk about the 7th Congressional District. It's wide open because incumbent Republican Rob Woodall is not seeking re-election, but it's also wide open, Chuck, because that district is changing. It's a target for Democrats. At last count, we have 6 Democrats and 7 Republicans lined up for the primaries in the race to succeed Rob Woodall. Some of these candidates have moved into the district. Former Fulton County Chair John Eaves, Fulton County Commission Chair John Eaves. So is it a scramble to find a message in a district that's changing, especially for Republicans in the suburbs?
It's challenging at both levels. It's going to be challenging in both primaries. I still think in a good Republican year, it will lean Republican. But there is no one dominant figure that I've heard of really on either side. I can opine for the couple that I know from Home Depot and from the state Senate. I think are outstanding candidates. They still have to prove themselves in the trenches of primary struggles, and it's tough.
But how do they get through the clutter? What message do Republicans have to send to not only their voters in the primary but to the general election, or do they even know at this point?
Well, I think people know the standard themes. Lower taxes, they're going to be for strong military. They're going to be for conservative values. They're going to be faith-based in many, many ways on a Republican side. The question is, one, how do you articulate that in a way that makes you different? But secondly, have that visceral gut connection, I think, in retail politics, which is the most important. Do people feel like you, one, care about them? Are you talking to them or through them? And do you show that you've had the past record business, phone, family, politics, otherwise, to feel that you can carry it out? And I don't have a magic wand.
This is not a district, though, where we're likely to see a candidate get into a pickup truck on a TV ad and say, I'm going to go round up illegal immigrants.
I think I'm going to agree with you. I think that I don't want to say safe bet about anything, but I think that's more likely than not.
You know, the thing that's really interesting about the Congressional 7th District, it's the number one pickup for Democrats in the nation. This seat is being targeted by Democrats nationally. The DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, has listed this as one of their top targeted pickup races.
Now, Chuck is implying they may be overestimating how well they can do.
I don't think so, because, you know, let's not forget, I mean, Rob Woodall won this election by less than a tenth of the vote, right? I mean, we're talking about a few hundred votes, but I think until those numbers came in Forsyth County, Carolyn Bordeaux was on the verge of becoming one of the people who upset, along with Lucy Metbath, a member of Congress.
And so do Democrats run against Trump? You know, because that appeals to the base, especially in a primary, or do they highlight issues like immigration, like health care, for instance?
Well, Carolyn Bordeaux spent an enormous amount of money and time on health care. One of the things that she talked about in her ads in the closing days of that campaign was basically protecting people who had pre-existing conditions, right? And she did a really good job of taking some votes that Congressman Woodall had taken and really linking him to sort of the national Republican Party, and did a good job of that. I think you're going to see a combination of that national message, depending on the polling, how unpopular Trump is in that particular district. But they got to figure out a way to localize it, because as you just alluded to, Dennis, this district is a melting pot of a lot of different ethnicities, a lot of different races, a lot of different demographics as far as class. You have people who've been there all their life, but you also have folks that are moving to these suburban areas because of the schools and the land. You know, the transit debate is going to come back up. And so this district is really so hard to kind of narrow it down to one or two or maybe three issues that a candidate can focus on. But I would tell you this, in a time where we know the presidential turnout is going to be higher than it was 2 years ago, I think it favors the Democrat he or she who prevails, because if it's Renee Utterman who prevails, or if it's someone
we're
else.
We're talking about a district that includes Gwinnett and Forsyth County.
Right, sure.
And Renee Unterman's very well known in Gwinnett.
She is, but
I was going to say, let me add one thing on that, because I know those two better than the others. But one, it's interesting, I really bring this up, because Theranin mentioned earlier about the Democrats' need to find maybe somebody out of politics successful. Well, you got one of the high executives at Home Depot, Ms. Amrica, who, by all definitions, seems to be a top-flight candidate against a grizzled veteran, Renee Unterman, who you say she has come up through every level.
I don't know if Senator Unterman would.
Well, I said lovely, beautiful, grizzled veteran, competent. But I have as high respect for that woman, watching her over the years, as anybody I've seen in state government. She's local, and she is the other side of that spectrum, which is somebody who's come up from the city council level up and had done well at every step of the way.
The other point that I want to make is this. I do think that a lot of people looked at what Carolyn Bordeaux was able to accomplish. And I think that's why you see so many Democrats who are running in this race. You have a young lady named Nabila Islam, who's very, very young, who's come in and who's had some good fundraising numbers. Of course, Carolyn Bordeaux raised the most amount of money. But if you look at Nabila, who's a person who is from that area, and particularly in Gwinnett, you know, her parents moved there. They're immigrants. She's going to be interesting. And, you know, John Eaves is, and I got to mention his name because he beats me up, Chuck. He says, he says that I don't ever talk about him. But, you know, how does he now have moved to Gwinnett County? And we saw John Ossoff get crushed, you know, locally and nationally by not actually living in the district. What many folks don't know in Georgia, you don't have to physically live in the congressional district to run.
No, we have some sitting members who don't live
well,
in the district.
Yeah, well, I was going to leave that alone. and I know that particular member, he's a big participant in this radio station. But, you know, it's just going to be so interesting, because I think Georgians have got to be ready that between District 6 and District 7 in a very highly contested U.S. Senate race, we better brace ourselves, because Georgia is going to be on fire.
I mean, the Republicans have to see this as a line in the sand, though. You cannot lose both the 6th and 7th and still be a voice of the major voice in the metropolitan area. They have got to focus the resources and have a campaign that clicks. And since I don't want to get beat up, John Eaves, I'll say his name.
Complete change of subject here, but it does tie into one of the issues that is affecting every race, and that's health care. The Obamacare challenge was heard in a federal appeals court in New Orleans. Two of the three judges on that federal appeals court panel asked questions that could be interpreted as a bad sign for the future of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Republican governors and attorneys general, including Georgia's Chris Carr, are involved in this challenge. Chuck Clay, suppose they win. Suppose the court, and maybe perhaps going all the way up to the Supreme Court, rules that without this piece of Obamacare that they're challenging, the whole thing falls down, which is possible. Republicans have no plan at this point to replace it with.
I'm not sure anybody does. It's a dangerous area. I understand the philosophical opposition and underpinnings of the lawsuit, and I respect that. Politically, you certainly can understand what that means in a Republican primary and to a lot of Republican voters. I don't think you play politics with people's fundamental access to health care. You got to have a solution, whether it's state-driven. This governor has very aggressively pursued the waiver programs.
He has,
which is
but
also,
it's based on Obamacare.
It is
a waiver under the Affordable Care Act. So if Georgia's challenge succeeds, along with that of the other states, is the state actually working at cross purposes now with itself?
At a very esoteric level, I say yes. In the real world, I don't think the two are going to intersect in a way. If there's a real warning shot across the bow, the appellate work will go on for years. There will be time to react. Neither side is going to allow 30, 40, 50, or even more million Americans to be wake up one day without coverage. They're not going to do that.
That includes hundreds of thousands of Georgians.
No question. You got to be very careful. And I hope, this is just a hope, I'm like everybody else, I hope these waiver programs really do create some new, innovative, creative ways locally, state level, to provide answers to your question.
Not all, but most Republicans have spent an enormous amount of time trying to take health care away from millions of Americans. We know, Dennis, that the Republicans in the Congress in 2017 and 2018, when they control both chambers, tried 50 plus times to try to repeal Obamacare. And the reason it fell was not because of effort, because they had it as a top priority, but it fell because they had no solution to replace it.
Well, they did have then Congressman Tom Price from Georgia, who actually developed an alternative plan, and even that was shot down by fellow Republicans.
It was. Oh. And now he has come back to Georgia and is working with this governor and others to try to help us move forward. But the one thing that's interesting is what Chuck just said, and I want to commend Chuck for saying that, is that you cannot play political. And I'm not saying Chuck said exactly like this. I do have a tendency sometimes to put words in Republicans' mouth. But what Chuck is alluding to is that, hey, be very careful about how you play politics with a fundamental right like health care that affects millions and millions of, and particularly in Georgia. And then, listen, let's call it what it is, Dennis, and you hit on it, and Chuck did a magnificent job of kind of coming down the middle on the issue. But what is going on in the courts contradicts what Governor Kemp is trying to do. It has done.
With the waiver plan.
And I've commended him on this show and took a lot of heat for Democrats for commending this governor for putting a Medicaid waiver plan forward in a time where a lot of folks were calling for true Medicaid expansion. But now to basically kind of be playing footsie with a court decision that, if passed, will totally derail what the governor is trying to do is a very tough position for Republicans to be in nationally and in Georgia.
Chuck, Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, who has a little experience in health care, a Republican, was asked by WABE's Sam Whitehead about what happens if the challenge succeeds. And the statement from his office to Sam said, "We believe federal and state governments, as well as the private sector, must immediately come to the table and enact a constitutionally sound health care law that protects pre-existing conditions," and on and on. It hasn't happened yet.
Well,
what makes the lieutenant governor think that it would happen?
Crisis
now?
Is the mother of all invention, as we well know. There's not going to be a sudden collapse of health care. I would argue that it's not an unalienable right in terms of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But it is it's such a paramount cornerstone of every family that there will be solutions and there'll be alternatives. But be careful.
Do the Republicans have time to put something together, though, if they win in time for the elections? Or, again, if the GOP challenge succeeds, does that suddenly loom as a real negative for them going into the 2020 elections?
Depends on how
no replacement.
Yeah, it depends on how it's handled. Obviously, they don't control both houses anymore. So that clearly indicates that if there's going to be some agreement, it will have to be a bipartisan, hammered out compromise. Now, can they do that? They ought to. Will they? We'll have to see.
Another thing that Attorney General Carr is involved with is the fight in Georgia against child sex trafficking. He has made that a priority. He has helped set up an office called the Human Trafficking Prosecution Unit. It was just announced back in May. But the latest charges against Jeffrey Epstein in New York, Theron, certainly raise the question of what Georgia is doing. Atlanta is often cited as a major transit point in child sex trafficking networks. The unit that the Attorney General and Governor Kemp has set up has a budget of about $370,000 and a staff of 6. Given the scope of the problem here, does the Jeffrey Epstein case say to Georgia, you got to do more?
Yes, and let's not leave out First Lady Marty Kemp, who has made this a part of her role as First Lady of the great state of Georgia to really combat this human trafficking and sex trafficking issue that we have in our state. Also, we have the world's busiest and most efficient airport. And so Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms has also made fighting human trafficking and sex trafficking a big part of her administration. And so this is something that I think you're going to see be elevated very, very quickly. And look, let's give this governor and this attorney general some credit. They saw that this is something that was running rampant in our state. Now I think this sort of gives them more ammunition to go to other agencies and other people to say, hey, we need more funding. We need more collaboration. We got to fight this issue.
I would say, and I spent 6 years as a prosecutor, this shocked me to no end to find the level of it. Kudos to Chris Carr. Kudos to Sam Olens, who started this earlier when he was AG. This ain't about Clinton or Trump. This is about a criminal monster and a trade that needs to be stamped out now.
Chuck, my colleague Rose Scott and I did a special that we spent a very long time on, and it wasn't that many years ago, on child sex trafficking and the efforts to fight it. This was back around 2011. And the legislature passed a revision of sex trafficking and human trafficking legislation after that special. But we were hearing, even then, from pretty powerful voices, a lot of them in the GOP, a lot of them from conservatives from a religious point of view, saying, look, we can't just allow prostitutes to get off with no charges. Their victims will take care of them, but they also, we can't sanction this behavior. That wasn't that long ago. Where the voices are very different now. They're saying these are victims, period.
Well, for children, I think that's true. I think it's, and it may be true anyway, but when you're talking about trafficking in children, they're victims. They ought to be treated and dealt with exactly that way, and witnesses.
Has this been a shift for some folks in the GOP?
I don't know that it's been a shift. I think it's been an education. I think people are now really, just in the past few years, really understanding how broad and deep and tragic this crime and all that's involved with it are on young children, young lives who are being destroyed forever, tragically. We got to stop it. So I think it's as much education as it is change.
Part of the problem in the Jeffrey Epstein case was how well connected not only he was, but some of the folks who were enabling or participating appear to have been, even though we don't know a lot of names as we speak. Now, we hear a lot in Atlanta about trafficking through places like Mexico with gangs involved. I mean, I've sat in on federal hearings involving that kind of thing. But the old question is the state ready to go after homegrown customers and traffickers, especially if they have connections like Jeffrey Epstein
yes,
did?
Yes, and I think both parties, I think it's a bipartisan issue. I can't say there's going to be perfection. This is one where the chips fall as they may. You're doing any of this business, you're condoning this business, you're facilitating this business, you need to be exposed and wherever possible, prosecuted.
I agree with everything that Chuck said.
Yeah, and the prosecutors at the federal and state level will have the independence and the resources they need?
Yes. It's different in the federal level. They budget long-term investigations. I know we're starting to do more of that, obviously, with budget constraints with the GBI and the AG's office. Working together, you're going to see a massive increase in resources to tackle this crime.
Bit of a radical change at the very end. We can't leave without a bright spot or two. And in the world of sports and sports as entertainment, we have found a couple of bright spots as we head into the second half of the year. The Braves are in first place after the All-Star break, doing very well. Coco Gauff, an Atlanta native, wowed Wimbledon, got into the second week. And, of course, the women's soccer team. And there's now talk of yet another try to get an Atlanta professional Major League women's soccer team located here.
Coco is here to stay for a very, very long time.
She, hope so.
She really, really hope blew so. Up the national stage. And then the one point I don't want to be missed about the women's soccer team winning the World Cup, which is great. They won the sport. But also, let's not let the dilution to occur of that message around equal pay. Mm-hmm. For women. That's one of the things that I think that if you look at all of their physical and public expressions, they're really fighting for equal women pay. And that's something I want to commend them on.
And Coco Gauff, Atlanta is a big tennis center for folks.
Number one tennis. More people play tennis in Atlanta, Georgia than anywhere. And big shout out to BB&T Atlanta Open that's coming up soon.
It's
number one tennis town.
Coco Gauff had to leave Atlanta to get her tennis training. Florida, of course, is a mega center for tennis academies and pros who train up-and-coming young prospects. I remember some talk after the Olympics in 96. We had the tennis center put in, and we were hoping that not only would it attract the amateurs, who certainly play in big numbers here in Atlanta, but that it could be a development center for young talent. Coco still had to leave all those years later. So you think that her success might actually spark some recruitment and development of young talent here.
A lot of people that I've talked to recently, you know, Eddie Gonzalez is a dear friend and colleague who runs the BB&T Atlanta opened. And Dennis, to your point, one of the things that he shared with me is he now has the luxury of having this at Atlantic Station every year. Yep. But before that, it was at Atlanta Athletic Club. And, you know, I'm a member of Ansley Golf Club, so I got to get that in for those of my fellow members. But tennis is a sport that a lot of people want to play. But I think with Coco's recent rise and victory, you're going to see sort of a recalibration of making sure that we don't let good talent like that mm-hmm. go to Florida. We can have those same trainers, those same facilities, those same things right here in Georgia. And I think it's something that
Do we see the impetus for it, though?
I think it's happening. I mean, Eddie told me that not only is it going to boost now because of Coco's victories, mm-hmm. but it's something that they've been fighting with Florida for a long time. And Florida has just, quite frankly, that Sarasota, Tampa, mm-hmm. Orlando, I-4 corridor area has done a really good job of recruiting these athletes.
Wasn't that long ago, Nick Bolotari opened that tennis school up down in Florida.
Legendary tennis coach.
That folks thought was sort of crazy. They've got a big jump, weather and all those things. But absolutely, airport, talent, passion for the game, I'm all for it. And Theron, if you're looking for a partner, call me. I don't have much in the way of cash, but I can certainly put a smile on the project.
You would beat me down pretty bad in tennis because you look like you can do it, but we can go play some golf really soon.
And a lot of communities that could really, with a lot of potential young talent, where tennis isn't reaching them yet.
And people said that. Coco's we've done it really golf now. That. We've become a golf place. People have talked about it with horses. Tennis is next. I'm all for it.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Filling in for Brian Robinson this time, former Georgia Republican Party Chair Chuck Clay, who's now with the law firm Hall Booth Smith. Thanks so much to you both.
Great as always. Appreciate being here.
Happy tanning, Brian, and bring me a t-shirt back.
And if you like this show, subscribe, please. And you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure that other people can find us. We'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now plugged in, a WABE Politics podcast. New name, same on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE Politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we talk to politicians and voters to break down each week's biggest headlines. New episodes drop on Fridays. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.
WABE.